from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some physical structures are so potent in their design, their presence, they become icons for a civilization, for Western civilization and its ideas of democracy. The most potent structural icon on the planet may be the Parthenon, the great temple above Athens, the Athens of the ancient Greeks. But my guest today says the Parthenon may be more interesting and challenging than we know. This hour, On Point, the message of the Parthenon and what it may say to democracy in 2014. Joining me now in the studio is Joan Breton Conley, professor of classics and art history at New York University, a MacArthur Genius Award winner. She's spent a lot of time in archaeological digs, mummy wrappings, new interpretation of the Parthenon. Her new book is The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the World's Most Iconic Building and the People Who Made It. Joan, thank you very much for being with us.
Lovely to be here.
It is so great to have you. And this is such a powerful piece of architecture just to begin with. You take us deep into reading it. But I was lucky enough once, maybe 10 years ago, to be there with my family, step back and look for a mile across Athens. And there it stands. And it does just emanate. Now, I know this is in our minds, but it just looks like the ultimate key to what we have thought of as Western civilization. Science, reason, openness, ideals of democracy. Do we read all of that into the Parthenon, or does it indeed stand for that?
When you have something as beautiful as the Parthenon, there is a tendency to be drawn to it and to see yourselves in it. So we have hundreds of years of projection onto the Parthenon of what all our ideals of what we understand to be civilized is. We wish to see ourselves in it. And to be sure, it is a pinnacle of excellence in architecture and design. It is a paragon of aesthetic beauty and proportion. But it is much more than that. We've had it wrong. We've missed the central message. We need to look at it through ancient eyes.
When I heard that that's where you were going, I thought, oh, no, don't tell me the Parthenon doesn't stand for democracy after all. In fact, that's not what you're saying. It's almost even a deeper understanding of democracy, or certainly an ancient Athenian understanding of democracy that's more challenging in some ways than our current understanding.
There is an urgency to the message that the Parthenon holds for us, and that is that Athenian democracy had at its spiritual core the values that self-sacrifice for the common good was paramount. Democracy could not survive without the notion of sacrifice.
We're going to look at how you pulled that message, which wasn't always necessarily pulled out of the Parthenon. Joan Breton Conley has been the spearhead, really, of this new generation of research looking at the Parthenon. Take us back to the history so we can understand a bit here. The construction begins in 447, 446 BC. It's finished in, 433, 432. This is the way, way back machine. What's the immediate history that leads up to the construction of the Parthenon? It may help place people in ancient Greek history, which is not so familiar, but certain things are. Marathon and more.
Well, many people find it surprising to think of the Parthenon as a replacement building, but actually it is what went up on their ground zero. The predecessor of the Parthenon was burned to the ground by the Persians, who invaded in 480 BC and sacked their Acropolis. Mm-hmm. But the Persians started marching from the east already at the end of the 6th century BC. In 499, there was what we call the Ionian Revolt. All the states of the western coast of what is present-day Turkey got together to repel the Persians, and the Athenians sent some ships. They paid heavily for this. Mm-hmm. The Persians came at Marathon, landed in 490 BC, and against all odds, the Athenians repel them.
But 190 or something Athenians dead in the records and thousands of Persians.
Absolutely. It was an epic victory for the Athenians, and they credited Athena with this victory, of course. 10 years later, however, the Persians pushed in again, and in 480 BC, they marched on Athens and did the unthinkable. They burned the temples on the Acropolis. Now, the Greeks had an unwritten rule that in wartime, you left the religious space of your enemy sacred. Mm-hmm. You didn't touch it. They were in shock. It came as the biggest surprise of all to see their sacred rock.
Their ground zero, as you say, that destruction.
Absolutely. And so, in the 480 at Salamis, they defeated the Persian fleet. And then 479, Battle of Plataea, finally the Persians are repelled. It took them 30 years to rebuild their Acropolis. And it was Pericles coming in as the man of the moment in 447 BC who led the charge.
The great Pericles. And it is not wrong to say that this was a moment when a kind of democracy, a potent kind of democracy, was taking root in Athenian ancient Greece.
A radical democracy, you might say. To be sure, it was a democracy for a small group of privileged men compared to our standards of an inclusive democracy. Women and slaves were excluded from this. But within this great experiment of this group of men, what they did in terms of full representation by the people to the policymaking of their city was absolutely revolutionary against the backdrop of their own contemporaries.
They had had tyrants. They knew what that was about. And you say Athenians, something in their nature made them ready to come out, stand together, and overthrow. There's a sort of American Revolutionary War Tea Party feeling about some of these uprisings that were very high stakes, but ultimately quite successful in Athens.
Athenians did not like to give power to one man or even one small group of men. They even resisted tyranny for the 7th century, and it was not until the middle of the 6th century that a tyrant, Pisistratus, himself emerged. But their sense of democracy was hard won, wresting it away from these tyrants in the last decade of the 6th century, and they were not about to give that up again.
We're going to look at the deeper meaning of ancient Greek democracy, Athenian democracy anyway, in the structure of the Parthenon, incredible history between then and now. It's been a cathedral when the Christian era came. It's been a mosque when the Ottoman era came. It's been destroyed and destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed. Take us back to when Enlightenment Europe began to focus on this structure and invest it with what message and meaning, John?
Well, it was in the 18th century that Stuart and Rivette, two British travelers and antiquarians, amateur architects and artists, first identified the Parthenon frieze as an image of Athenians marching in their annual Panathenaic procession, a kind of 4th of July parade of the Athenian civic body as a whole.
And when you say the frieze, you're talking about the sculptures up in the along the roof line of the Parthenon that are so beautiful and many not there anymore, many famously taken off to London by, the Elgin Marbles escapade.
Yes, exactly. This is a relief band in the exterior colonnade, high and in the shadows, just beneath the roof, which is very long, 524 feet of relief sculptures. So in investing in this period of study of the Parthenon during the Enlightenment, when the political ideals of association of democracy with the Parthenon and a reading of the building itself as an embodiment of Western politics, so to speak, came to the fore.
They saw it as an ancient endorsement of the project that they were engaged in.
Again, we all love to see ourselves in something beautiful and astounding, and this is the beginning of a trend that continues to this day.
So when they looked at the Parthenon, I mean, when I looked at it across that Athenian skyline, what jumped out at me was science, was math, was proportion, was algebra. It's so powerful in its just simple dimensions. But they took that further. They said, what, here's reason, here's rationality, and here's democracy. Did they see democracy in the procession or in the structure itself?
In the procession, they saw the citizen body as a whole, all participating in it. So this is the primary message of civic collectiveness. But the iconic nature of the astoundingly beautiful and accurately proportioned building became the ultimate symbol icon. What is missing in this whole equation is what it meant to the ancient Athenians. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, a deeply sacred space, a temple among temples. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to do is to get back and to see the building through ancient eyes. What did it mean to the people of the 5th century who built it? Above all these things it has become across the centuries, to be sure, are valid. But at its beginning moment, it was the great enterprise that brought people together in rebuilding something that had been destroyed by the Persian enemy, their Acropolis. It was a great uniter of the people of the time, and ultimately it was a thank you gift to Athena.
The great goddess who was at the heart, of course, Athenian worship. There, 1832, the French poet Alphonse de Lamartine declares the Parthenon to be, quoting here, the most perfect poem ever written in stone on the surface of the earth. And when you look on it, it is absolutely powerful and moving to this very day. After all its ruination and restoration, all of its different manifestations, Joan Breton Conley takes us back to the time of the ancient Athenians and the meaning they invested in the Parthenon. Well, look at that. It turns out to be challenging to a democracy, maybe to ask more of itself. The new book is The Parthenon Enigma. It's remarkable to look at the legacy of that connection between Enlightenment-era Europe and the ideals that they saw in the Parthenon and the architecture of Europe and the United States and the young and developing American democracy. So much architecture echoing, referencing the Parthenon.
Well, Greek Revival architecture imitates the Parthenon, and in doing so, it aligns itself implicitly with a set of values. That is the burgeoning of young democracy. What is fascinating to me is that we have expropriated what is basically religious architecture for secular buildings, libraries, banks, governmental institutions, mm-hmm. universities. And in so doing, we have again moved away from this central idea that it is a temple architecture, that it is a religious architecture that has been appropriated for secular usage.
And yet it was democracy that was coming out of that. Describe for us that connection between what you describe as the religious origin of the Parthenon and the civic structure that we see in ancient Athens at this time, not always, but in this period with its democratic profile.
First and foremost, we must realize that there was no separation of church and state in the ancient Athenian democracy. The Greeks didn't even have a separate word for religion because there was
just life.
No facet of ancient life lacked a religious aspect. So politeia, what we call politics mm-hmm. today, had embedded within it all things to do with religion. In my book, Portrait of a Priestess, Women and Ritual in Ancient Greece, I look at the role of priestesses, which are really those not of church ladies on the fringes of the central political acts of the city, mm-hmm. but in fact, they are indispensable executives who are responsible for the running of the cults, which are central to the working of the polis. So we must understand that our notion of secular and sacred did not exist for them.
It was their religion. We call it their mythology, ancient Greek mythology. It comes into play very much in the Parthenon itself. That was living what braided through with a very particular culture in Athens. Thucydides reports to us how others on the Greek peninsula itself saw this culture. You've got a little reading from Thucydides there. Maybe you could set it up for us a little bit and describe who was talking about the Athenians here and what was so remarkable about the Athenian, ancient Athenian character.
Here we are on the eve of the Peloponnesian War, and the Spartans summoned together all the members of what is called the Peloponnesian League to decide what to do about Athens. The Corinthians, who live much closer to Athens, are very nervous, and they're frustrated with the Spartans. They don't think that they are realizing and understanding the danger that Athens...
What a potent culture and society this is.
So the Athenian delegation contrast what the Spartans are against what the Athenians are. And I read from...
This is the Corinthian delegation doing this.
The Corinthian delegation is mm-hmm. trying to persuade them to get going. Speaking to the Spartans, You have never considered what manner of men are these Athenians with whom you will have to fight, and how utterly unlike yourselves. They are revolutionary, equally quick in the conception and in the execution of every new plan, while you are conservative, careful only to keep what you have, originating nothing, and not acting even when action is most urgent. They are bold beyond their strength. They run risks which prudence would condemn, and in the midst of misfortune, they are full of hope. They are impetuous, and you are dilatory. They are always abroad, and you are always at home. For they hope to gain something by leaving their homes, but you are afraid that any new enterprise may imperil what you already have. When conquerors, they pursue their victory to the utmost. When defeated, they fall back the least. Their bodies, they devote to their country as though they belonged to other men. Their true self is their mind, which is most truly their own when employed in her service.
Just a remarkable passage saying, wake up, Spartans, these Athenians are special. You can imagine societies, you've done more than imagine, over the centuries flattering themselves, saying, oh, that sounds like a description of us, and Americans in particular, as he describes them as revolutionary, intrepid, full of hope, and on and on. That sounds like something Americans would like to say, that's us.
Well, I have to say that I do think that these tenets, this idea of enterprise and getting out there and industry and being abroad and doing business, all of this comes out of a democratic thinking mind. So it's not an accident that these are American values as well. It's coming out of the notion of democracy, where you believe you can do anything.
But there's something we may not have fully pulled out of this, and the story of the message in the Parthenon that you mine here goes back to a mummy and papers wrapped around a mummy and the reading of that and back into ancient, even more ancient Greek mythology. Unwrap that for us.
There has been an anomaly in the Parthenon that has disturbed many over the years, and that is that this frieze that we have mentioned has been believed to show a scene from historical reality.
That would have been sort of present-day Athens at the time of the construction
of
Parthenon. Snapshot
of 5th century
Athens. This is how we live.
Yes. If this were true, it would go against all conventions for Greek temple decoration, which always chose subject matter from the mythical past. Mm-hmm. But we had had no myth to fit the images. All this changed thanks to the recovery of a lost play by Euripides that was remarkably peeled off of a papier-mâché mummy casing, a mummy excavated in 1901 in the Fayum Oasis in Egypt, brought to Paris. It sat there until the 1960s when a method was devised for putting it in a steam bath with hydrochloric acid and glycerin.
It's an unbelievable story.
Peeling off these fragments of papyri and recovering the ink script written upon them. We got 250 new lines of a play by Euripides that was first performed around 422 BC, just 10 years after the completion of the Parthenon. And this play knocked my socks off when I was reading it for the first time.
Because it conveys a myth, an important story to the Athenians that you say informs that sculpture around the top of the Parthenon, the frieze.
This is what they chose to put on their most prominent temple. And in fact, the scene above the door, just as you enter, is a scene of the first king of Athens, Erechtheus, his wife and three daughters. He has been told by a Delphic oracle that in order to save his city from a marauding band of barbarians, he must sacrifice his youngest daughter. And so he goes to his wife, Queen Praxithea. All of this is laid out in the new text. And he says, what shall I do? And she says, of course, we must give our child. No one family should put itself above the common good, even the royal family. This is astounding when we look parallel to what was happening in the world at the time, that not even the most elite of the city would put themselves above the common good. And when we look at this image on the frieze, the central panel, we see mother, father, and three daughters. The king and queen, Erechtheus and Praxithea, had been unaware of the fact that the two older daughters had made a solemn oath with their younger sister that if one would die, the others would die as well, in solidarity with their sibling, and so they threw themselves off the Acropolis. Erechtheus himself is killed in the ensuing battle, but the Athenians win, and at the end of this play, Queen Praxithea stands alone on the Acropolis and Athena appears to her. Here is the Queen of Athens who thought she was giving one child to die for all. Instead, she gave her entire family. And Athena then instructs her, bury your daughters in the middle of the Acropolis and build a temple. Bury your husband and build a temple. It's so simple. The two temples that stand to this day on the Acropolis, the Parthenon means of the maidens. The Erechtheion means of Erechtheus. It is a basic foundation myth. So this new text, it informs what we're looking at on the frieze.
So if we go back 2,000 years and more and stand before the Parthenon, this is not just a parade that we see there. This is a very specific story with a very specific message about what democracy requires for Athenians at that time.
Absolutely. And it reinforces what I've just read in the Thucydides passage, that the Athenians are exceptional. They have a founding myth, but their founding myth is one that goes to core values that make them different from everyone else. And the entire democratic system depended on sacrifice and trust. You trusted your fellow citizens that if you lost in one instance in a policy decision, you had faith that down the road, the chips may fall in your favor. So you are willing to give on this issue because on the next issue, you had real trust in your fellow citizens that they were looking out for your best interests. This is a very beautiful notion. And in our time where we focus on individual rights and freedoms, sometimes it's good to look back on the Ur moment of democracy and see how the collective good really took precedence over everything.
So flash forward to when democracies actually begin in the more modern era or Enlightenment age to be planted and develop. Are you saying that Western democracy as we know it today missed something? I think a lot of people would say, well, we rather understand that ideas of sacrifice and trust must be in there, but maybe not with the centrality of the ancient Athenians.
We have to recognize that our notion of democracy is quite different from theirs. Our founders certainly, when they were setting out the charter for American democracy, were very concerned about balancing individual interests and how difficult this would be. They wanted to implement a concern for individual rights almost as fundamentally as the common good of the republic itself. Mm-hmm. Our emphasis on individual rights is quite different from theirs. Theirs was really on ton kalon, the greater good, the good for all. And they had a collective understanding of themselves, the glue that held them all together. What we have is a kind of great welter of conflicting wishes of various groups, and this is very difficult to reconcile. They put above everything the idea of the group. I think there are urgent lessons for us in this. It is good to reflect on the first democracy and what was important to them.
They're a society where the most powerful, maybe the most wealthy, the king, willing to sacrifice, at least in myth, but as the supreme icon on the Parthenon, his own children.
Absolutely. The ultimate sacrifice.
I want to bring our listeners in here, if I may. Joan Breton Conley is with us. Her new book is The Parthenon Enigma. And it should speak to us today. Henry in Akron, Ohio. Thank you very much for calling, Henry. You're on the air.
Hi. I feel like I'm talking about my childhood when I listen to this, because I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia. And everything that's been said is absolutely, I agree with it completely. The town plan of Williamsburg reflects a sense of democracy. Bruton Parish Church was the first building that they constructed. It's at the center of the town. While they had to deal with the king, and the king did, Parliament did tell them to pitch the roofs. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, because it was one of the centers of urbanity at that time, as the town developed, it very much reflected that sense of democracy in the architecture, in the way the land use was scoped out and developed. And Williamsburg is still today doing digs and finding information that it's just amazing how much the discussion of the Parthenon holds true to Colonial Williamsburg in terms of the urban fabric.
And the symbolism, the power of civic architecture in Williamsburg as well. Absolutely, Henry, and I'm so glad you raised it. Joan, what about that power, civic architecture, and maybe what the Greeks saw in their most prominent display in the Parthenon, what Americans see when you look at Washington today, when you look at Colonial Williamsburg, when you look at our civic architecture, can you still see with all of your study here, do you see a difference of inflection in democracy somehow embedded in the very stone?
The Acropolis, even in its archaic phase, had sculptural programs on its temples that told the genealogy of the people. Where do I come from? The most basic human question. So the pediments, that is the gables of these great temples, were billboards onto which you could project the story of where you came from, generation by generation by generation, going into the cosmic and epic past.
And it was not all people, it was a people. It was the Athenians.
It was the Athenians. And of course, they believed they were all from the same seed, that they came out of the ground together. They cared most about genealogy and the blood connection that they all felt they had to one another. So these temple pediments, the imagery on architectural sculpture informed generation upon generation of the founding message, the founding ideology. And what is so interesting, that in a world in which the entire population could not read, the visual took great precedence in teaching, paideia, in teaching the next generation. We do consider our founding fathers. I would say that we have less of a giant visual tradition for them. We don't see them everywhere in the way that an ancient Athenian would have seen Erechtheus, or would have seen earlier.
Or Athena from miles away, the giant statue that once stood there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But we have adopted the architecture as a sort of iconic. But again, we come back to the separation of religion from civic life, which we have and which they did not have. So it's all about the big visual, the focal point of the city. A monument like the Parthenon went a long way in educating people. And by the way, the Panathenaic Festival was celebrated there for 800 years. So we have a mold in the development of what it means to be an Athenian. As children, as young adults, you would go through the same process.
We're going to hear in just a moment from another great scholar of the Parthenon, but if you could just read a little bit from near the end when you're summarizing what you see in this structure, Joan.
At the very heart of Athenian democracy, then, lies the conviction that no single life, even a royal one, should be set above the lives of the many. In the first century, John's Gospel will define the zenith of love in this way. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. That this notion of self-sacrifice as love, which sounds so familiar to us, should have been subscribed to at Athens 450 years before Christ is hugely significant, revealing how a trust in one's fellow citizens allowed rule by the people to endure, even through crises such as only the most authoritarian state could have otherwise survived. Democracy, in its various forms, has ever since remained, at bottom, a balance between the individual's obligations to the community and the community's responsibilities toward the individual. It was not all self-sacrifice at Athens. For 200 years, the radical Athenian experiment was sustained in no small part by voluntary contributions made by well-off citizens to support those who had nothing. At the same time, an ethos of self-restraint and respect for the law, and above all, genuine concern for other Athenians, high or low, they were all descended from the same exalted stock, ensured the balance.
Joan Britton Connolly, reading from the Parthenon Enigma there. Joan, stand by. I want to bring another august scholar of the Parthenon and ancient Greece into our conversation, if we may. William St. Clair joins us from St. Andrews, Scotland. Now senior research fellow with the Institute of English Studies, School of Advanced Studies at the University of London, but long a big figure in the study of ancient Greece, author of Lord Elgin and the Marbles, the Controversial History of the Parthenon Sculptures. William St. Clair in St. Andrews, Scotland, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be on your program.
It's wonderful to have you. I think you were there some years ago now when Joan first began to roll her thesis out here about a new interpretation of the frieze at the heart of the Parthenon. How was it received then? How's it received now? Are scholars of antiquity on board with Joan's interpretation?
Well, I certainly was there when Joan first took her ideas around the universities. It was at Oxford and also in London I heard it. And it was greeted, I have to say, by some of our colleagues in the profession by disdain. And she wasn't, her ideas weren't essentially taken seriously by the leaders of the profession at that time. But now that her book is out, but I've got the proofs, but people will soon be able to read the whole book, the middle part of her book is absolutely terrific. It takes the central part of her thesis that the frieze represents a myth, and that the myth has to be that of Erechtheus, and proves this point by point, takes up objection after objection and deals with them. And I think myself that the textbooks and the art history books will have to be rewritten to take account of that. But can I also say that although I agree with almost everything that Joan has said on the archaeology, I think on the association with democracy, it is possible to offer a rather different emphasis, which I could do now if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Because the building was, it was an official building built during a period in the history of Athens when it did have a democracy, a limited democracy, male citizens only, didn't include the slaves. In fact, the whole system was based on a slave culture. It was a very aggressive, brutal society which went into other people's countries, enslaved, massacred, genocide in some cases. But this did coexist with a time when philosophy and art and drama were all being developed uniquely, and indeed science, which was mentioned. So we get here a society that is not one that we would want to copy in all its features. I think also The construction of the building was not particularly intended to celebrate democracy as a form of government. It was intended to celebrate the continuity of the city and the unity of the people ready to sacrifice for one another, for the general good. And that is not necessarily an idea which is connected inseparably with democracy. I mean, pretty well all states try and use iconography to get a notion of unity and national unity. The other point I make is that it's always dangerous, I think Joan said about projection, to cherry pick through history and pick out one particular episode and say, well, that's us, or that is particularly relevant. The Athenian democracy, even in its limited form, only lasted for quite a short time, about 100 years out of 2,500 years of the monument. And there were lots of other forms of government which were attempted and tried or imposed in Athens. So a reading which links it too closely with democracy, I think is wrong. It's much more that the city goes on because the city, or the people who live in the city, and provided they hang together, the city will continue to flourish.
William St. Clair, standby in Scotland. Joan, how about it? Yes, a message of self-sacrifice, but you know, many kinds of society with many kinds of governance might appeal to that notion. Do you see something that specifically links that notion to democracy in this structure?
I think we have to view it all in response to the wake of the Persian Wars. We have a burgeoning of stories in Greek tragedy, Sophocles and Euripides, especially of virgin sacrifice. This is how to avert social crisis by one person giving to save the community. And this is specific to Athens, especially in the years of the third quarter of the 5th century when we get these plays and onward. I do believe that that this notion of sacrifice, and here I'm following Danielle Allen, the political theorist who has written quite a bit about the notion of sacrifice at the heart of democracy, is specific to Athens when you compare it to what's going on in other city-states at the same time. The fact that the Athenians chose to put this on the east side of the temple and above the door tells a lot. That is, if we go to other temples and other centers, like at Olympia, where you see the royal family above the door and about to take place in a chariot race, you get the central message of the founders of that place. We see the same thing at Aegina and the pediments there. So of all the things that they could have chosen, they put in the place of prominence the central message of who they are. And the fact that they chose a scene of virgin sacrifice for above the door says it all. We must not forget that the word Parthenon, and it's omega and it's genitive plural, it means of the maidens, place of the maidens. Mm. So it is directly linked to this extraordinary thing, this extraordinary story against the backdrop of all other stories of other city-states, that the Athenians figured this out. And I think they figured it out because they had the ultimate shock, the Persians on their Acropolis burning everything down. You respond to that by saying, let's all get together. Let's be a community.
William St. Clair, I want to bring that to you. Let me bring a caller or two in first, if I may. Montez is calling from Bonnow, South Carolina. Montez, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thank you for your very interesting discussion. I have a question about the use of color on the Parthenon. I was pleasantly amazed when I learned that the marble actually was not in its purest white, that in fact there had been use of vibrant color. Could you comment on that and how you think that looked through Athenian eyes?
Wonderful. Yes, thank you, Montez. Joan, yes, color, we think of it as white, gleaming white, everything white. Why?
Again, this is how we wish to see it from the 19th century, this idea of pure white against the blue sky. The colors have faded, but you'll be happy to know that the Parthenon Enigma lays out all the new discoveries of polychromy on the Parthenon marbles, which have been many in recent years thanks to new technology.
Was it just in interior paintings, or was there exterior color?
Exterior color, bright colors. It would have looked like a Czechoslovakian Easter egg.
Wow.
Very bright.
Wow.
Garish to our eyes, even.
Wow.
Of course, this is normal, but what's so exciting is the last 30 years have seen the Acropolis restoration program that has focused on taking the Parthenon down block by block, cleaning, examining, scanning, laser scanning, and putting it back together again. We have learned so much, but most excitingly, on the southwest corner, where there was, in Frankish times, built a spiral staircase in brick that served the bell tower of the cathedral Our Lady of Athens. This brick had, since the 15th century, been right up against the marble of the porch. This was taken down, and it revealed beautiful, bright colors that had been not seen since the 16th century. So this is terribly exciting. We also have been able to do some laser scanning on the West Frieze, and that we could imagine it with reds and blues and greens and gilding.
A Technicolor Parthenon is kind of amazing to imagine. William St. Clair, it doesn't seem entirely accidental, though, that Western culture likes to see it as pure white. There's some kind of sacralizing almost that's gone on, isn't there, in the way we've come to want to understand the Parthenon as white, almost like an icon of new secular religion. What's that about?
No, I think that's right. And this goes back to the 18th century, where theories were produced that the essence of sculpture is form, as distinct from painting, which is colored. This is an idea developed by Winckelmann and picked up by many others. And it was, I think, associated latterly, with racism, actually, that Western sculpture and modern Western sculpture that you find in cathedrals and so on is white and the eyes are blank, whereas in all countries east, sculpture is full of color. And this point about polychromy that the caller in mentioned was ideological as well as a matter of archaeology. In that it was used to separate the ancient Greeks as being somehow like modern Western Europeans and Northern Europeans and whites, to separate them from Oriental people, the Egyptians and the Persians and so on, whose art was much more colorful.
You say take care in ascribing too much of a democratic message here, though Joan points to the fact that this was built in a time of the flourishing of an Athenian democracy. Why is it, after so many centuries, in the Enlightenment era, do you think, that Europeans and Americans picked up the Parthenon as a symbol for so much of culture that would be associated with democracy, William St. Clair?
Yes. I mean, the democracy that existed in England and in the early United States was very, it was also very limited. It was confined to white men with Thomas Jefferson, Tom Washington. They were white men with estates full of slaves, and the women were not included. And they also were in favor of colonization and bringing subject peoples under their rule. So there was a much more direct read across, I think, in the 18th century. People who regarded themselves as Democrats, but we would not ourselves now regard them as Democrats, to the history of ancient Athens in the 5th century and 4th century.
Irresistible. William St. Clair, author of Lord Elgin and the Marbles. Thank you so much for joining us for a few minutes today. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Joan Britton Connolly, we've just got a minute here. Give us your message, your ultimate message out of this reading of the Parthenon. It may not be exactly the same as William's, we hear that, but it's very lucid and potent in your book. What does it have to say to us in 2014 in our American democracy?
The Parthenon matters. It matters because it holds an urgent message which we do well to focus on today. Where do we come from? Where have we lost touch with the original democracy? How are we different from it? Democracy can be a messy business. How did they do it? How are we doing it? How are we like them? How are we not? We repay our efforts when we focus on the ancient past. It holds messages that enrich our lives today and help us to better understand the way forward.
And the self-sacrifice theme?
We all need to take a deep breath and wonder about how much we have participated in the ultimate sacrifice. Today, in our discussions, it is limited to discussions of the military for the most part. What sacrifice are we making to the collective good? What part can we play in making this democracy in our day work?
Really a terrific, terrific and deep read on an absolutely splendid piece of architecture and much more. Joan Britton Connolly's new book is The Parthenon Enigma, A New Understanding of the World's Most Iconic Building. and the people who made it. She's been with me in the studio today, and what a delight. Joan, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Great to have you right here. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.